comes.
Jonathan works with us, works at the same place I work, and he came up to me today at the office and he said, "You know, the Emma's first service is tonight." And I was like, "Great." So if she doesn't ever want to come back to church, I guess it's all on me. That's no pressure there. That's great. She's still asleep? Okay, then we're all good. All right. We're going to introduce to you tonight Sunday school. How many of you guys grew up going to Sunday school? How many of you remember the flannel board? Man, flannel board was cool, right? Yeah. I mean, when they put that camel up there, and then you'd see Joshua, and then, you know, he'd show him with him bound up, and then, you know, just cool stuff. And then, you know, now we have to have, like, PowerPoint, which I didn't prepare, and video games and things of that sort. But I remember thinking when I was in Sister Bear's Sunday school class in Lebanon, Missouri, with the flannel board, I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. Well, we're going to go backwards a little bit. We're going to go back to Sunday school because I think there's so much that Sunday school brings to the table that we don't get in any other way, shape, or form. Sunday school brings us the opportunity to do what I think is a great thing, ask questions. Because I remember when I was a kid, and they would be talking about certain things and from the Bible, and in that group of peers, I could raise my hand and ask a dumb question. And the only saving grace I had is everybody else was wondering the same thing, and only Wittenberg was dumb enough to ask. See, Sunday school brings us that. So in the Sunday school class that Sandra and I will be teaching, our first series is going to be on the book of Judges. And the reason we've chosen Judges is because whenever we did the survey about what do you as a congregation want to see offered in Sunday school, the number one request was Bible stories. And I thought, man, that's great. Because I think there are times that we can get the gospel so complicated and so aloof that we forget that he's a God of very simple stories.
That's right.
That we can apply to our lives. And the fact is, a lot of people in my age group simply don't know the stories.
That's very true.
Sandra and I, when we got married, she was raised in a home very different from the home I was raised in. I was Ken Wittenberg's son, which meant every time the church doors thought about being open, we were there waiting on them to open. So I was in a deacon's home, and we were just always in church. Sandra was not raised in the same home. She went to church once when she started dating me. I mean, it was a very different framework. And so whenever she was reading Bible stories to Shelby, our oldest, when Shelby was probably 18 months, 2 years old, it didn't really strike me as that odd, but Sandra was hearing these Bible stories for the first time. And I remember her telling me, you know, I didn't know that that was a real story when I heard about the donkey talking. And you think about how much you take for granted if you were raised in a good Sunday school that taught you those Bible stories so that you've got a foundation to put faith on. But you think about a new Christian coming into the faith now at the age of 18 plus, they don't have that background. And so by starting off in Sunday school, whether you're in Dean's class or Daryl's class or Daryl's class, I guess we've got, hi, I'm Dean. This is my brother Daryl, my other brother Daryl. But by the way, I'm the only one that can use that. Anyone else uses it, it's corny and it's worn out, okay? So, but whosoever class you're in, by starting off with Bible stories, we're going back to where God wants us to get our foundation. And I'm excited about that. The sad thing is, though, when you ask many people about reading the Bible, a lot of times their response is, oh, I don't read that much. It's too complicated. I don't understand it all. I don't really, well, to be honest with you, it's kind of boring. We're not that excited about it. And unfortunately, the idea of reading a long list of do's and don'ts and these and thous and begats, it's not that exciting to me either. I find myself in that same boat. And every once in a while, I catch myself either putting reading my word at not the top of the list, but it's somewhere in there, then it may get accomplished today or this week or sometime or maybe not. And then I catch myself feeling guilty about the fact that I haven't read, so I make it one of those things I got to check off. Anybody ever been there with me? Where, okay, I read my Bible today. Didn't really get anything out of it. I just got my 3 chapters in. I am holy. You know, you've all been there, right? Please don't let me feel like the only one. Well, it's those times that I like to go back to Judges. So that's the series we're going to start with in our class. And the reason I like to go back to Judges, now I'm sure a mature intellectual person would go to Judges because there's some great doctrine there. Some great lessons for life. Things that you can just meditate and really dig into the Word. I'm not that guy. I like to go to Judges because it's gory. There's bloodshed. There's a lot of carnage there. Some cool stuff. Some of the best stories, I think, in the Bible are found in Judges. In fact, how many of you guys know the story of Jael and the Nael? There's this story, and we'll get to it in my class. This is my little sales pitch for the class, where a woman named Jael, there's a guy running from the Israelites because he's been a bad guy, and he's been harassing the Israelites. He's a Philistine, and all of us, no, he wasn't a Philistine. He was an Amorite. But anyhow, he comes, he's running from Deborah and the armies of Israel, and he hides in the tent of Jael. And Jael, being a nice, hospitable southern gal, says, "Come on in. Rest a spell." And he says, "I'm thirsty. Get me some water." She goes, "No, I have something better, some warm milk." Doesn't that sound good on a hot day that you've been running for your life? Warm milk. Yum. Probably from some hairy, nasty camel outside the tent. Yeah. But yeah, she gives him the milk and she says, "Here, rest your head on this pillow." And he falls asleep. And it says that she took a hammer and a tent peg, and I love how the Bible puts this, and drove it through his temple into the ground, and he died. In case you weren't clear that having a tent peg from here to here would kill you, Judges clarifies it. Don't tell me the Word of God is complicated, folks. Okay? It's extremely simple. It's in the book of Judges that we're going to be spending 6 to 8 weeks covering our first in a series of life classes. This series will be one that will open your eyes to great stories of faith. But what I really hope it does is it starts building a little bit of a hunger. It's good, Jared. It makes you want to get up in the morning. And before you start anybody else's to-do list, you talk to the man who created the universe and wrote something every day for you.
That's great.
Because if you'll do that, I promise you, you'll live a life and you'll have your own stories.
That's right.
That you get to share. Tonight we're going to start by laying a little foundation for this study and by explaining how and why the book of Judges came to be. We're going to discuss the reason the book still has meaning for our lives today and how we can apply those lessons from Judges and how we can avoid the same pitfalls that the Israelites found themselves making mistakes over and over and over. And then, in fact, one of the great things about reading about the Israelites is basically if you don't catch the lesson in the first historical book, just hang on. They'll make the same mistake here in another couple years and you can learn it all over again with them there. So it's not real complex again. That's what I love about Judges. Judges, if you read most historical accounts and most people's opinion, most believe that it was written by Samuel. And if you're not familiar with who Samuel is, he's the first of the great prophets. He was also the last of the judges. He kind of carried dual titles. And he was the one who led the transition from a band of kind of confederated tribes or associated tribes, not really a nation, to where they had a monarchy for the first time. And that was kind of Samuel's role. He was the last judge and led them into the monarchy. But what Samuel really did is he clarified the mistakes of the past 100 or so years, 200 or 300, 400 years of Israel's history and why they had made so many mistakes and what they had to do to change the path that they were on. It's kind of a bridge, if you will, from this band of wandering construction workers wandering around the desert that really had no clue In fact, if you read much of Numbers and Deuteronomy and Exodus, when you read that story, you find out, good night, folks, 10 plagues. What'd you not get? He's God. But if you look at those lessons, it's ones we can apply to our lives, because 10 plagues, what'd we not get? But if you read Judges, you see this as a bridge from Joshua and his capable leadership into the monarchy, or into being on their own. We can look at Judges as kind of a description of Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. Now, I had to memorize this in Thelma McClure's sophomore English class, and Thelma would be so proud today because I can remember about half of it. Believe me, if you had said in that class, you'd be impressed with how much I can remember as well, because I don't think she thought I was going to graduate. But his poem goes like this. Two roads diverge in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both. And be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, and just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though, as for the passing there, had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay, and leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. At the end of Joshua, the book that precedes Judges, we see that Joshua is setting them, the Israelites, in a position to make a choice. They will be in a position to make the choice to either do exactly what God has called them to do, or on the other hand, to lean on their own experiences and their own knowledge and walk the more traveled by path. Just like Mr. Frost says, the path they chose, as you read Judges, made all the difference. Joshua framed this in verse 15 of chapter 24, when it says, "But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your forefathers served beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Key word there, will. Choice. You get to choose. We will serve the Lord. In other words, Joshua is telling them that they have a choice to make. He had just ran down a litany of miracles that God had performed on their behalf, building the resume and the reason for following God's path. And so he goes through all of these things, and he also tells them about the promises and the curses, the blessings of obedience and the curse of disobedience. He goes through that with them, and then he tells them to choose. You see, Israel had a choice to make, just like you and I. We can either live a life that will scream our obedience and our devotion to God, or we will live a life that mutters our lack of understanding of what has been done for us. We get to choose. Let's look at what choices the Israelites made and where it led them. Under the capable leadership of Joshua, the Israelites had a phenomenal series of military campaigns. They were undefeated. They had grown so powerful as an army. And again, we have to kind of frame this a little bit, because when we watch, someone help me, he was Moses in the movie, Charlton Heston. When we watch him leading that 200 people through the desert, that wasn't what it was. There wasn't, 50 people and a bunch of cows and a few sheep walking through the desert aimlessly. There were 2 million people going through the desert. In fact, if you read some of commentaries on the Israelites and what they had to have every day to survive, it would take a freight train 17 miles long, with Keith Sloan leading the front end of that thing to bring them food and water and wood. 17 miles, folks. And we kind of read these stories as though they're just kind of neat. No, that's a miracle. That's a phenomenal miracle. That 2 million people could survive in the desert, their clothes don't wear out, they don't die, they don't get sick, none of those things happen, and every day there's food and water and wood. If you've ever been in the desert, there's not a whole lot of any of those things around.
That's right.
So it's an amazing story in and of itself. But they've come through this, and under the capable leadership of Joshua, this band of construction workers, slaves, people who didn't know which end of the sword to hold, have come against some of the strongest city-states in this region of the world, probably the strongest in the world at that time. And they had those people quaking in their shoes because at this point they had never been defeated. Every time they went out with God's blessing, they were destroying cities. Absolutely destroying them. It says in Joshua chapter 11, verse 12, Joshua took all the royal cities and their kings and put them to the sword. He totally destroyed them, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. Yet Israel did not burn any of the cities built on their mounds, except Hazor, which Joshua burned. The Israelites carried off for themselves all the plunder and the livestock of these cities, but all the people they put to the sword until they completely destroyed them, not sparing anyone that breathed. As the Lord commanded his servant Moses, so Moses commanded Joshua, and Joshua did it. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. If you did not catch that last part, we see that God told the Israelites to destroy everything. Everything that breathed. Now I'll go ahead and tell you, that messes with me a little bit. Because we think, oh, it's okay to go in there and destroy the army. That's fair. What about the 75-year-old grandma who's crippled? You kill her too? About the 6-year-old little boy? Pregnant mother? Yeah. And see, that kind of messes with my picture of God being this genteel old southern gentleman who wants me to get up on his lap and tell me about all I want. Because that's not him. It's hard for us to come to terms sometimes with the fact that God is extremely jealous over those whom he loves. You see, he's not this kind old gentleman. I prefer to think of him as an extremely protective father. I've got two kids. I've got a 14-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old boy. And I would gladly put to the sword anybody who wanted to take away their innocence, who wanted to rob from them what God had promised them. That's who God is. When he said destroy every living thing, he didn't do that because he was angry at the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hittites and the Parasites. Just want to see if you caught it. He wasn't angry with them per se. But what he knew is that if he let his children go into that land that he had promised them, not just then, this promise goes all the way back to Abraham. Whenever God told Abraham, you will inherit this land and your descendants will outnumber the grains of sand on the seashore. This was their land from back then. They were coming home. They weren't being moved to a new land. They were coming home. And there was someone else living in their house. And God knew that if he let them stay, that they would dilute the purity of his children.
That's right. That's good.
And so he said, you've got to destroy everything that draws breath. God was a very protective parent. The Israelites, after hearing from Joshua and being told to make a choice of whom they would serve, chose wisely for a while. It only took one generation of the Israelites to lose the promise and returned to slavery. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And they buried him in the land of his inheritance. And I'm going to butcher these names, so go ahead and laugh. Timnath-Heres in the hill country north of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. And after the whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, which generation? The generation that had triumphed under Joshua's leadership. Another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what had been done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshiped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook and served Baals and Ashtaroths. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to the raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders, yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshiped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned away in which their fathers had walked. They quickly turned away from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. I've got a question for you. How in the world can you prostitute yourself to a people's culture that's been totally destroyed? How can you be taken captive by a civilization that no longer exists? How can somebody who no longer has any power, who no longer lives, lead you to another religion? Can't happen. But a little bit of compromise. Because you see, taking that land, killing those people, the Israelites weren't any different than you or I. They have hearts. I'm sure killing children was not something they particularly enjoyed. Fighting the battles wasn't something they wanted to do. Being pure wasn't easy. So a little bit of compromise. A little bit of justification. And they became slaves. So what does that have to do with us today? We can't very well go around killing everybody who isn't a Christian. I'm going to leave that to those of you who are chuckling. We'll pray for you later. How can the lessons of Judges be applied to our lives in 2008? The first lesson of Judges is very, very simple. It's so simple, in fact, that it may go unnoticed at first reading of this text. The lesson is this: do what God says. It may sound simple. I like the cookies on the bottom shelf myself. Do what God says. Choose who it is this day whom you're going to serve. You see, we make this choice every time we make decisions on the conversations we're going to take part in, the entertainment we choose to entertain ourselves with, and the way in which we treat those, both in a professional and in a relational manner. We have to apply three very simple rules to our lives that will help us keep from living a life of compromise and then defeat. In order to do this, first, we have to know the Word. Now, that sounds simple enough, and it really is as simple as it sounds. The problem is it requires this thing called discipline. And we don't really like that word very much. I don't. I really like the holidays. You know, no discipline. We're all going to sit around and eat cheesecake and drink coffee till midnight and be surprised in January when our clothes don't fit. You know, I don't understand, but I love the holidays. I love that. We're gonna let our kids stay up all night long eating all kinds of stuff we don't normally let them eat. I speak from experience. And then be angry with them the next morning when they won't get out of bed. Anyone else been there? My kids, literally, I grew up on a farm, okay? If the sun was up, we were up. And so I go up and wake my kids up at what I think is a generous late hour, 7:30. Sun's been up for an hour, folks. We're burning daylight. And I get these looks of hatred coming from my children. I don't get, "Oh, Father, so good to see you this morning. How can I serve you and make your day better?" No. We had some weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. And that's when I left our bedroom and went to go wake the kids up because Sandra told me to leave her alone. Please pray for me because I'll pay for that later. We need to know enough of the Word, and we need to have enough of it rolling around in our thoughts that when it comes time to make a decision, the Word's influence is of greater impact than the culture's influence.
That's good. That's good.
We need to quit making decisions on our feelings. The fact of the matter is they lie. They do. There are days that I feel very down, that I'm not worth anything, that I can't accomplish anything, but the Word does not tell me that. And it's not the truth.
That's right.
There are days that I feel like I can conquer the world, that I look like a Greek Adonis. That's also not true. My wife tells me that's not. No, I'm sorry. She doesn't say that. That's twice. I'll stop now. Again, pray for me later on. By knowing the Word and consequently its author, we will be able to make decisions that will bring forth the promises that are guaranteed in that Word. You see, every promise in the Word is yours to take, literally.
That's right.
But every one of them requires your action.
That's right.
I don't know why we're surprised sometimes when our life is frustrated by the fact that we don't live in God's blessing, but we constantly do things out of motivations that aren't in congruence with His Word. That doesn't make sense. When you live a life that is in congruence with His Word, you can expect His blessing to be there. And it will be. It's a promise. And He doesn't go back on them. If you read Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 12, it gives the instructions that were given to Israel prior to entering the promised land, and it's the same instructions we can live by today. It says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. These commands I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit down at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them to your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. When the Lord your God brings you into the land He swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, a land with large, flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things that you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then, when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt and out of the land of slavery." You see, it's very true, folks. God's blessing can become your curse. It's not His fault. Not at all. He's a good father. I can speak from experience with this in Sandra and I's lives. About 6 years ago, we were given an opportunity to start our own business. And man, God has truly been there. It's just been awesome. Some of the things that have come to pass. This redneck kid from McLeod County that grew up on a dirt road, just what God's been able to do with an extremely simple mind has just been amazing. But there are times that I catch myself getting so busy with doing things that I consider to be very urgent that I don't do anything that's important. And I allow Him to get on the back shelf. And just like a good father, He lets me fall down. He lets me skin my knees. So I have to get reminded again, oh yeah, I've got to get back in the Word. I've got to remember where this came from and not let the cart get before the horse. That brings us to the second thing that we need to do to apply to our lives. And second is talk about God and who He is with your children. If you don't have children, go find some and talk about God and who He is. But this does more than just bless the children. And I will tell you, it will bless the children. There is nothing as important to the development of your children's spiritual walk, nothing more important than you having very honest conversations about God with them. I'm not talking about do's and don'ts, about don't wear that, don't go here, you can't do that, can't smile, be dour, you're a Christian, what's your problem? You know, not that. Let's talk about where faith meets life. Talk to them about your struggles. Talk to them about how God's met you in your hour of need. Talk to them about how God is real. He's not just someone you read about in this. No, he's the God of 2401 Sunspot Lane. That's where I live. That's who he is. When we started our business, my daughter was 9. She still thought I was cool. She's 14. That comes and goes right now. But I was cool at 9. Shelby came home from school, and that day was really a cool day because I'd gotten fired. Yeah. Those days aren't that fun. And Sandra and I had a choice to make. I had a couple of job offers from some of our competitors. Well, we could roll the dice. And I remember we prayed about it, and I really felt God wanted us to do what we did. So we started our own business, and I set Shelby down. She was 9. I said, Shelby, I need you to know something. I said, today, Mom and Dad started their own company. And I said, you're going to remember this day for the rest of your life. I said, because today's the day that you're going to see that God meets every need you ever have. And you'll never be able to say, I don't know if there's a God. Now, you may not follow him because that's your choice, but you will never be able to say that there is no God because he will meet every need we have. Now, I don't know who that proclamation of faith was more directed toward, Shelby or Daryl, because we were operating out of our garage, and had most of our customers known that, the orders would have been canceled, I'm sure. But Shelby and I have revisited that talk a couple of times since then. And I was exactly right on. In two ways. He's met every need. And she'll never forget that talk. And that's leapfrogged into some other things that are springboarded us into some other conversations about, well, why purity? Because remember, there is a God. He's not just here. He's here. And that's why purity is important. Why can't I watch that movie? Shelby, because there is a God. And because we don't watch that movie, because there is a God. And he says to flee from the very appearance of evil. Why can't I go to this place? Because Mom and Dad don't go there. And why don't Mom and Dad go there? Because there is a God. Remember that talk? And because he said to not associate ourselves with that kind of stuff. If you'll talk about that with your kids so you don't just grow their faith, man, there's something powerful about stating a goal. And when you express as a leader of your home, Mom and Dad, you know what? We're going to live a godly life. We're going to do things right. We're going to do things that God would be pleased by. We're going to be some of those people, not like the ones in James where it talks about those who make it to heaven as though through the fire. I mean, they barely make it. They kind of come dragging in with nothing to offer. And I don't want the Wittenberg showing up that way. I want a U-Haul dragging all the stuff that we have to offer. Not because I'm proud. So you get to make a choice. Two roads. Talk about it with your kids. See what kind of an impact that has on their life. Third, make your decisions from a kingdom mindset. I'll tell you, this is the hardest one for me because I am not very patient. Anybody who works with me can tell you that I am not the easiest person to get along with when things are dragging because I want things done now, and why aren't we doing them yesterday? I mean, I'm very, very impatient. See, kingdom mindset's not like that. Kingdom mindset puts God's things first, puts his priorities ahead of my own, puts my wife's comfort ahead of my own, puts my children's future ahead of my comfort and my feelings. That's not easy for me. But you see, a kingdom mindset is one that trusts that God is who he says he is, and what he says is true actually is true. It's a mindset that puts the kingdom, both heavenly and here, first. This will be made evident in how we exercise our options. It will show up first. See, I'm not on staff, so I can say these things. In your checkbook, it's going to show up in your entertainment. It just does. I can say it from experience in the Wittenberg household. That I can tell you that you will see your priorities in your life and what you truly value by looking at your checkbook. You investing in God's kingdom? You investing in His stuff? I'm not just talking about your tithe. I mean, how much are you investing in God's stuff? Because you want God investing in you. And then in your entertainment. If you're entertaining yourself with the things that God says are detestable, if you're laughing at the things that He says are an abomination, and you're amazed when God doesn't feel present, there comes a time when you have to choose which path you're going to walk on. And it's small choices. It's small choices.
It's very good. Amen.
If our entertainment lasts at the things that God says are sinful, wrong, and detestable, what does it say about our heart? If you read Matthew Henry in his commentary on the entire Bible, he had this to say about the book of Judges. The people of Israel were very careless of their duty and interest. Owing to slothfulness and cowardice, they would not be at the pains to complete their conquest. It was also owing to their covetousness, they were willing to let the Canaanites live among them, that they might take advantage of them. You see, if you had Canaanite slaves, you didn't have to work real hard. They had not the dread and detestation of idolatry that they ought to have had. The same unbelief that kept their fathers for 40 years out of Canaan now kept them out of the full possession of Canaan. Distrust of the power and the promise of God deprived them of advantages and brought them into troubles. Thus many a believer who begins well is hindered. His graces languish, his lusts revive. Satan plies him with suitable temptations. The world recovers its hold. He brings guilt into his conscience, anguish into his heart, discredit on his character, and reproach to the gospel. Though he may have sharp rebukes and be so recovered that he does not perish, yet he will have deeply to lament his folly through his remaining days, and upon his dying bed to mourn over the opportunities of glorying God and serving the church that he lost. We can have no fellowship with the enemies of God within us or around us, but to our hurt. Therefore, our only wisdom is to remain in unceasing war against them. War. It's really what it is. The Israelites had to go in and destroy every living thing that represented anything that was detestable to God. And we have to destroy everything in our lives that's in contrast to what He would have us to live. Choices. Just like Mr. Frost said, they make all the difference. In our class, we're going to spend time in discussion over these things. We're going to have points that we talk about every day. But what I hope really takes place, what I really desire out of Sunday school, is what I call Tuesday morning Christianity. Because I'm hoping that on Tuesday morning, when you're faced with that conversation around the water cooler, I'm hoping that Mr. Frost comes back to you. And you remember there's two roads right there in front of you. Which one are you going to take?